Okay. I would start off just with a definition of Torah, and that is one that we've been expounding all along, and that is that Torah is the one system, the only system that teaches man how to serve God through knowledge and through intelligence. And this definition is not my definition, it's the Torah's definition. As the Torah says in Deuteronomy 4:6, it says, "And you shall keep them, meaning the commandments, and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, who shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people." So Maimonides uses this as his barometer, by the way, and he mentions that in his introductory remarks here, that the Torah itself gave us the best barometer of what it is. It states that it is your wisdom and your understanding, and other nations will see that this is wise and intelligent. Therefore, he says, any idea that is not wise and intelligent, that cannot be presented to an intelligent person and will not evoke a response from the intelligent, a favorable response from the intelligent person, then you should know that that definitely cannot be Torah. I gave a class last week to our high school, the high school in an area, and after I got finished, one of the youngsters, a high school student, came over to me and he asked me about some mystical idea. So I told him, I said, no, we don't believe in that. So then he proceeded to ask me, well, why? So I said, why? Because it is stupid, and we do not believe in stupidities. And that's not my my own idea. It's the Torah's idea. The Torah says that is the barometer. Anything which cannot be accepted by an intelligent person cannot be correct. The Torah is constructed in a way that it appeals to the most intelligent human mind. Of course, I mean, the person has to study. You can't just present the law to a person and say, do you like it? They have to study the law and see exactly what it is and understand it. No, nothing is, it's not simple, but it's intelligent. Now, the thing is that last week, I'm going to use this as a little introduction, but I'd like to get back to what we said last week. Now, I understand that some people were disturbed by the idea that, about this candy bar idea. Now, just let me explain something. Maimonides uses a candy bar in his parable, but of course, it doesn't have to be a candy bar. Oh, there's a reason why he uses that, but in a parable, you don't have to stick to the exact case. He uses it in order to make things simple. Of course, I mean, you have to realize that when raising children, the ultimate candy bar for the child is really the love of the parent, or the avoidance of the parent withdrawing their love. Okay, so that's really the ultimate candy bar, but it is virtually impossible. When you train children, and children want to do things in order to please you, that's very nice and necessary. But of course, that's not the ultimate reason. The ultimate reason to serve God is not to make your parents happy, but it's because of the truth itself. But this concept of doing things because of the truth itself is a concept that a person cannot have at a very young age. A five-year-old, a six-year-old cannot understand what that means, and therefore, in order to draw them to the proper life, in order to train them, it's necessary to use ulterior motives. Even a grown-up person says that they're interested in truth for the sake of truth itself. That certainly is possible and is admirable. But even there, we have variations of degrees among people. There are some people that are really interested in truth for truth's sake. Other people may be partially motivated by that, partially motivated by something else. I mean, I know a friend of mine is a physicist, and he said at first he went into that field because he figured, look, studying God's universe, what could be more beautiful than that, and he was sure he'd find very ethical people among the physicists. But he was in for a big surprise, because he found that people who study physics were really interested in getting to the press, immediately publishing things in order to in order to gain credit for it. And there were terrible battles going on as to who said what first, and who's going to get credit for it, and etc. So we were surprised to find that even there, most people were not really involved in uncovering the ideas of God's universe for its own sake, but they had ulterior motives. They wanted to gain some kind of fame or popularity or a good position with their discoveries. Albert Einstein, of course, was a man of a very high high caliber, and he always used to say that a person who makes a discovery, he already received his reward. His reward is the discovery and the knowledge itself. Accolades are not necessary. But that's, now you're talking about a very high-level person. But there, and in between, there are different shades of people, okay? So when we talk about an ultimate concept over here, we have to recognize we're in order to make things more graphic, to demonstrate them, it's always easier to give a parable in extremes, because when you give extremes, you could easily identify what you're talking about. But you have to understand that in real life, it's not extremes, but there are various shades. And that really is a major part of the process of perfecting oneself. That is, that a person should reach a level where the only thing they care is itself. And that's why, as I mentioned last week, in Torah, even though one has knowledge of God's existence, and one is not does not believe in God, so to speak, as a faith kind of thing, but he has knowledge of God's existence. He knows that God exists. His mind has gained enough knowledge in order that that conclusion registers clearly in his mind. So then, belief is not really a part of his religious composition. It's knowledge. It's like you wouldn't say a physicist believes in physics. He knows physics. A mathematician knows mathematics. And that really is the goal of Torah. The first commandment is to know that God exists, not to believe that God. Belief is really a low level. Knowledge is a much higher level. But even when one has reached that knowledge, he still is not finished, because then the perfecting of the self first begins. And the person has to work on their own emotions, and they have to be able to arrive at a level where really all they're interested is in truth itself, for its own sake, not for any kind of recognition, not for any kind of admiration, just because they value the fact that they are living in a true world, in God's world, and that is all they need. They don't need anything else. A person who is on such a level, as you will understand, does not really experience very much frustration, because with the good is readily available to them, and they are constantly involved in it, and they're constantly in a state of bliss, because that which they truly want is available to them, and there is very little frustration involved in life. So that kind of existence is really the most superior existence. And those in existence are the only ones that really have knowledge of what it's like. Most people are too far removed even from that world, and they have a difficult time even envisioning it. And now, what I would like to do is by the way, the reason why Maimonides gives the candy bar example is, if you take a careful look at his example, he has four examples. First, he gives the candy bar. Then he gives, the second thing is the clothing, the third thing is money, and the last is praise and admiration. And the reason why he does that is because, parenthetically, he's showing you which parts of man's emotions are more basic and primary and which are secondary and are more developed. So he shows you the first most basic desire of man is for the physical, that's the food, the candy bar, so to speak. The next is for a little psychological pleasure. Psychological pleasure is clothing. You have to be a little older for that, okay? Then it is money and power. And the fourth, which is the ego itself. The ego itself. That is the most powerful. People will give away money in order to gain ego, just like many politicians will put down millions of dollars to get an important office, because that really is the most powerful drive in man, without a doubt. And Maimonides gives that. That's why he gives that elaborate mushal parable, because he is parenthetically showing you how man's drives set themselves up. Okay, I just want to show you that when a wise person gives a parable, and when Maimonides writes, every step is accounted for if you look into it carefully. There are no extra steps there, and the parable itself is specifically to give you knowledge of what is primary in man's desires and what is secondary and more developed and more powerful. Okay, now he'll come back to that also. You'll see a little later as to why he does that. Okay, let me take up something else. Now this. The next step that I'm taking up is a bit on the abstract side, but I think if I didn't take it up, I would not be doing the subject matter justice, okay? What we're saying at this point is that there is a part of man that does part of the eternal, and that is his intelligence. With intelligence, man tunes into a different world, a world that's beyond the physical world, and this world becomes very real to him, even more real than the physical world. Like to a physicist, the equations and the ideas of the universe are more real than the actual physical objects, because physical objects come and go, but the equations determine eternal laws. So to a person in thought, the ideas have more reality to him or her, and they have more reality, and they sort of move out of the kind of reality that most people live in, all right? And they live in a different kind of reality, and they sense that it's more real. It reminds me of what there's a book written by Einstein and Infeld on the development of physics, and he speaks about the concept of a field, which is something which cannot be seen. He says to the physicist, it's as real as the chair a person is sitting on, and that is true, and that is true in the world of Talmud as well. To the Talmudic scholar, the ideas behind the laws are more real than the actual laws themselves. I'll give you a statement from my teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, which he mentioned one time on the 9th of Av, which is a day of mourning, as you know, for the destruction of the temple. So he said that, for me, mourning over the temple takes on a different form, he says, because for me, the temple is alive and well. I know the ideas of the temple. I studied the tractate of Zvachim, Menachos, Yuma, and all the ideas of the temple are real in my mind as if the temple exists. So he says, for me, it's not that kind of a loss, of the physical loss. He says, if I could do all the avoda, the holy work that's done in the temple on Yom Kippur from beginning to end, without flinching, because everything is before my mind's eye clearly. So for the scholar and for the layman, I mean, the Torah caters to both, but the essence of Torah always resides in the scholars, in the scholarship, and that's That's the place from where the halacha always comes from. That's the from Zion shall go forth Torah. It means the from the Sanhedrin. They're the wise men, the ones that have the knowledge. They are the source. But of course, the practices are appreciated by everyone. But the scholar has a different view of the world of Torah, just like a physicist has a different view of the physical world than a plain average layman. It's a different kind of an experience. As Rabbi Soloveitchik said, the temple for me is still alive and well. I enjoy the beauty of all the ideas behind the physical structure. So that is real to me. It's real, it exists. That's a concept that may be hard to appreciate, but it's one which I think is important to keep in before one's mind. You know, in Torah, we have the principle that even though we may not be on the highest level, but we should study the higher levels, and even the highest level. Even though we study the actions of a very great person in Abraham, we're not on that level, but we must keep that before our mind's eye, so we have the model, even though we aren't on that level. But that's part of development, to keep those ideas in front of us. So it's important to recognize the fact that the world of the scholar is not the same as the world of the layman. Of course, other religions, you know, did not really appreciate that idea, and they try to say just the opposite, that the simpleton is really the ideal. Torah does not believe that. Torah never has believed that. And the prophets and the Torah itself and the proverbs and et cetera, I mean, always single out this this point, that the knowledge is the essence. Now, let me just continue with the point that I wanted to get at. And that is, we're going to head into a bit of an abstract point here, and that is that we explained that the idea of the soul is that part of man that can appreciate the eternals. The eternals meaning the idea. That's the part of man which is partaking of the eternal, which proves that there must be something inside of him that is eternal, otherwise he wouldn't have that tool. Okay? Now, the part that survives the physical body is precisely that part. Now, I'm going to go into a question. You see, the point you have to remember also is the Torah is not a book of sensationalism. The Torah is really a book which presents ideas in two levels. In a basic way, if you read it casually, and yet if you read it carefully, the scholar sees deeper ideas. But it does not cater to sensationalism. Most people are into sensationalism. Like people want to know, well, if they were, at the time of the resurrection, how will people get up? With their clothes on, their clothes off, you know? Or what if a person was a cripple? Will they get up healed or not healed? I mean, these are the kind of questions that people ask. What are we going to do in the afterlife? They're concerned about, well, will we know? Will we have family? Not have family. Do we know what's going on Earth, or we don't know what's going on Earth? These are interesting kind of questions, but the kind of, you know, they're questions that laymen always preoccupy themselves with. Scholars really go for the more meaty points and actually leave these things, because a scholar knows that you may not be able to ascertain many of these areas, especially the area of an afterlife, which is an abstract area. But the scholar knows that it's important to say I don't know, just like it's important to say I do know. So let's forget about these little points that we don't know, and let's see what we do know. What we can know is the concept, as I mentioned before, that there is a part of man which partakes of the eternal. That is demonstrable. Let's be happy with that bit of knowledge. But there is something more which Maimonides goes into, and it has to do with the enjoyment of the existence of the afterlife, which is intriguing. But I'm just going to say, like I said, again, he does not go into when we say the enjoyment of the afterlife, it's not going to be things that people are going to associate with their curiosity is going to be satisfied by. But from a logical standpoint, it is very substantial. And this is what he states. He says that I may have mentioned this last time, that just like the blind man cannot know what color is, and the deaf person cannot know what sound is, so too we cannot know what the experience of the afterlife is. Because in the afterlife, what happens is the soul is free from its relationship to the physical, to the instinctual. All right? Now, the question is, when it's freed, and I mentioned last time that according to Maimonides, there's no such thing as a spiritual enjoyment in this world. In this world, every other, it's a manifestation of the instincts, either essential instincts or psychological. So the psychological is really like a derivative of the instincts, and every enjoyment that we have is basically... In the next world, in the afterlife, when that part of man survives, which is eternal, does he have enjoyment or not? So Maimonides states, and this is basically the way he explains the concept, and of course it's backed up by the prophets. But let me just get to the idea. The prophet says, "How great is the good that you have kept for your fear you." Okay? Now, so we know from the prophets it is a great good. And the great good is something which is extremely enjoyable. Now, I'll just try to explain that. Now, the word enjoyment over here is something which we have to be careful with, because we associate enjoyment, you think, well, party, you see? Okay. But let's just look at it this way. The enjoyment over here, Maimonides says, is such a superior kind of enjoyment that a person who would have that experience would look down with disdain at every pleasure he ever experienced in his life, even the greatest pleasure. He would simply look down at that, and he wouldn't even want it. And he gives as an example, he says, you see that people, when they get older, and this goes back to what we mentioned before, When a person gets older, they substitute psychological pleasures for physical ones. Psychological pleasures seem more important to them than physical ones. When they're younger, it's more physical. Kids are interested in more physical, playing, you know, food, having fun, watching television. But then when a person gets older, he's into more psychological pleasures, being an important figure in immunity, gaining respect, money, more psychological pleasures. Now, the person, the grown-up, looks down at the other pleasures and would never be happy with them. If those were all the pleasures he could have, he would be very unhappy. He looks at those as being inferior, but he has superior pleasures. And in the same manner, Maimonides says, but much, much more so, he says, if a person would experience the pleasure of the soul that the soul has in its function of knowledge and contemplation, he says the person would frown upon every other pleasure and look at it as if it's nothing, would have no desire for it. By the way, that's one of the reasons why in this life we could not possibly have a real spiritual enjoyment. Because if a person would have that, his free will would never be in existence anymore. Because that enjoyment is so superior that he would never be attracted to any other kind of psychological or instinctual pleasure, because he would realize immediately how inferior it is. But it's part of the reason, part of the union of the soul with the man's physical makeup, that part of that union precludes any real spiritual, and this is tied to the physical. And because it cannot have that enjoyment, we have free will, because the soul functions and tells man what is true, but on the other hand, the physical pleasures keep drawing and gnawing at him, presenting him with another kind of reality, and man has to make the choice between the reality that his intelligence and his mind and his knowledge tells him is true, and between the reality that's being portrayed constantly by the world of the emotions. And those two pull on the person in two different directions, and that's where the free will comes in. Of course, you should be aware of a fact while I'm on the subject, that most people aren't really involved in free will, because the free will experience is only possible with knowledge. And that's why the Torah says that, behold, I gave to you this day life and death, and you shall choose life. Because before this day, the rabbis emphasize that, this day means before this day you really didn't have a choice. Why? Because if a person has no knowledge, then they're simply going to follow one emotion or another. That's not free will anymore. That's just psychological causality. There is a causation in psychology, and a person just left alone will do different things and even make different decisions, but these decisions are based on a tug of war between various emotions, and the one that comes out on top is going to determine what he does. But there is an experience of free will, and that is where the mind and the Torah mind, the mind that has the knowledge, sees exactly what the good is, and the emotions try to portray another reality and distort the knowledge that he has in order to draw him into the sphere of the instinctual and away from the real good, which his mind perceives. And that's, again, another reason why, even though a person knows that God exists, he is constantly involved in that tug of war between those two worlds. So the knowledge of God is only the beginning, the basis. That's why the prophet says the beginning of wisdom is the knowledge of God. That's the basis. Because without any knowledge, and the more knowledge you gain, the more free will you have, because the more you see what the real good is, and when the draw of the emotional good plays on a person's soul, he has to make that decision. Okay. All right, now let's get back to this to the point that I was mentioning before, and that is that the soul, once it is freed from the body, finds itself in a new state of existence, a different kind of existence. Then the pleasures of the soul come into being, so to speak. Okay. Now, what can we say about that? We can demonstrate that there is such a thing as a part of man which can tune into eternity, to the eternal world. That's not hard to demonstrate. But when we're speaking about the pleasure or the enjoyment of that part, that becomes more difficult, because it is something, as the prophet says, only God has seen. No man has ever seen it, has ever experienced it. So only God knows what it is. But can we in some way have some insight into what that experience is like, the experience of the afterlife? Okay, that's a valid question. Now, it's interesting. Maimonides states that even though we could never, it seems to be state something which is contradictory. Like, he states that he states on the one hand, a person can have no knowledge of it, but then he says a more intelligent person has more knowledge of it. Well, I mean, either you can or you can't have knowledge of it. What does Maimonides mean by those seemingly contradictory statements? Okay, that's what I'm going to clarify now.